The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And our guest today on Maltin on Movies is the esteemed
Maestro Giacchino.
Michael Giacchino.
Well, wow, and I love how you pronounced it, too. That was fantastic, because it's I get Giacchino, Giacchino.
Michael Mochaccino.
Yes, Giacchino. I mean, just pretty much anything you can imagine. Nobody's seen. I mean, it's nothing new. So no offense to anyone who's mispronounced it. It's just all my life. It's been like that.
But it's phonetically spelled. It's right there.
I think the two C's is what messes people up.
Oh, okay.
You know, so they want to put that ch sound.
Beware the two C's. Okay.
You know, it just doesn't work.
Oh, well.
But, you know. But I actually, and we always have this argument within the family. My grandfather was like, no, Giacchino, and my brother John still says Giacchino. And so there's even a rift within the family.
Depending on who you speak to.
Yes, exactly.
This is getting tough.
And we're from New Jersey, so you have to be careful with us people.
Well, yes.
Just like the Maltons, right, Daddy?
Yes, the Maltons from New Jersey.
Just like the Maltons.
Hey, do you ever watch The Sopranos, folks? Remember, they were from Jersey.
Yes, exactly.
That's all I have to say. I'm leaving it right there. Musical sounding family.
Yeah. Yeah,
Sopranos, you know.
Yeah, but chose not to be musical. Chose to do other things instead.
That's right.
Mean, terrible choice.
So just to get this out of the way, can I get a list out of the way, and then we don't have to look at the list again?
Get it out of the way.
It's a long list.
So you're saying, so who is this pleasant sounding guy, Michael Giacchino? Well, he's the guy who's written the music that you've heard in Mission Impossible 3, Ratatouille, Star Trek, Up, for which he won the Oscar, Let Me In, Cars 2, Super 8, Cloverfield, the main title only, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Jurassic World, Star Trek, Into Darkness, Tomorrowland, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, Inside Out, Zootopia, Doctor Strange, Rogue One, and the upcoming Spider-Man Homecoming, War for the Planet of the Apes, The Incredibles 2, Jurassic World 2, and other numbers yet to be determined.
Right. Well, it's funny you said Spider-Man, because we were joking while we were recording. We were saying, "Oh, what's Peter Parker's? What was his name when he came over on the through Ellis Island? They changed it to Spider-Man." He was probably there saying, "My name is Spider-Man," and they're like, "Spider-Man, okay, there you go. You now are living down in the slums of New York." That's that. Anyway,
so you've written a whole lot of music.
I've written a lot of stuff,
Anybody who is kind of watching movies.
Mm-hmm.
Or listening to, we didn't mention your TV credits, Lost and Alias.
Oh, right, yes.
Among
others. I've never heard of those shows.
No. It's
never
small.
Heard of them.
Look, most of these projects, to be fair, are small, independent little movies that not a lot of people end up seeing.
I know.
But one day. Yeah. One day. I'm going to get to work on one of those big movies.
Right? It's you and a little Casio. Just dink, dink. I can see it.
Yeah.
So here's the question. What did you listen to on the drive over?
I don't listen to music in the car. I generally listen to old radio shows.
That's
I love
good with us.
Johnny Dollar. Johnny Dollar.
Are you a Bob Bailey Johnny
yes,
Dollar?
Yes, yeah. Okay. Yes.
Do you know
yes.
what you've just unleashed? Do you understand?
I love The Shadow.
Shadow.
All of that stuff. X-1 is like one of my favorites. That show was the best. I love science fiction.
You mean XXXX minus yes. minus 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 1111111.
I told you don't know what you unleashed.
Yeah. I love it. So that when I'm listening to the radio, that's what I'm listening to. And thank God XM has this station just Right. That's all they play are those things. And I love them.
That's so funny.
Because you're a smart guy.
Right? I was thinking about this. I was like, why am I so obsessed with these things? And I thought, when I was a kid, I used to take my tape recorders into the movie theaters and tape every movie I saw.
Please
don't tell anyone.
Statute of limitations has run out.
I still have all the cassettes. Mm-hmm. I would tape Raiders, Closing Count, whatever it was, whatever movie it was, I would record it and I would go home. And that's what I listened to in my bedroom at night. Like when I would put a speaker underneath my pillow and that's what I would listen to. So it was basically like listening to the old radio plays. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking maybe that's why I love these things so much, because as a kid, that's what I used to drown myself in.
Yeah.
It's just audio, you know?
Well, my wife and I love it too.
Mm-hmm.
We listen to it in the car all the time, it being old-time radio. And there's something about it we find mesmerizing.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I love it, and I love because it forces you to imagine what is going on. It forces you to imagine the surroundings they're in, all of those things. And I just love that. And I also have this great image in my head of just America at that time sitting around radios listening.
I could never picture that. My parents used to say, I'm a child of the first TV generation.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents used to say, well, you know, we used to just listen to radio.
Yeah.
And it's like, you did what? You just sat there? What do you mean you just sat there? You sat there, you listened to a box?
And you stared at the wood box.
Well,
yes,
what was
exactly
that? And I never could grasp that somehow.
I love it. Well, my parents did the same thing. My dad would tell me about these radio shows and all. And I just love it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And this means then that you're following in a tradition, because Bernard Herrmann started working in radio.
Well, that's the greatest thing about when you're listening to these things, and tonight's score was composed by Bernard Herrmann, and you're like, what? He did what? That's so there's always these things that come up, or Jerry Goldsmith or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, there's
exactly
all of these great names that pop up, and you're just like, that's so cool. And one of my best friends, he also listens to them too, and he would, you know, if we happen to be listening at the same time, he'll call, did you hear they just said this and that? And I was like, yeah, I was listening to that. It's so crazy.
All right. So I'm going to put a cap on this now to so that my daughter doesn't murder me.
I'm not going to murder.
So this doesn't become an entire podcast about old-time radio.
He says that he and my mom listened as if I wasn't subjected to it my entire life.
Yeah.
The thing is, what we found, so I'm a Jack Benny nerd. That's my favorite.
Well, they play that on there too,
which
is fantastic.
I love Jack Benny.
Yeah.
And Dennis Day was one of my first crushes, which is a weird thing when you realize. I don't think I saw a photo of him until I was probably like 14 or 15. Just loved it. We quote it constantly. We quote Jack Benny all the time in our household. As for all the other stuff, because we like Dragnet, but it doesn't always play as much as well as we want it to.
Yeah.
But The Shadow and all those, I mean, those are our.
And I love Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke is a great one too. I don't even know why I like Johnny Dollar so much,
because
it's like it's an insurance man.
It's America's fabulous freelance insurance.
Exactly,
it's so
funny. And then when they come up and they talk about the receipts that he keeps and all of that stuff, or whatever he did, tank of gas, 13 cents, and
all right. Now, this is how I'm going to put a cap on it. All right. Let this be a beacon. To all of you listening, try old-time radio.
Yeah, listen to
it. It's really good.
It is fantastic.
Now, of course, there's crappy old-time radio,
right,
too.
Well, there is. But if you're interested in science fiction, and I think if you start with a series like X-1.
Right, or Dimension X.
Or Dimension X, you're going to find these. It's the same thing with the composers. You hear these names, these other writers' names coming up. You're like, what? That was,
Robert Heinlein.
What's his name? I'm in the middle of a
Ray
big
Bradbury.
Star Trek book right now, so everything in my head is Roddenberry.
Ray Bradbury.
I mean, all these writers who are just incredible science fiction authors, they were all doing this stuff. And you're just like all the stuff you love, you'll be surprised to see how much of it actually
and
came.
And there's so much of it. There's so much to discover.
Yes.
Thousands of hours.
Yep.
He's obsessed with sound effects.
Yeah.
And so when we go to see live radio shows –
recreations.
Well, when they do the recreations, that's our favorite
thing. I love that too.
I love the little door that you slam.
It's
that sounds
so great.
Like it. And walking, the clip-clop, all that stuff.
I found a shoebox full of my old cassette tapes, and I was going through it, and I found, I used to read, I loved Hardy Boys, growing up. Loved the Hardy Boys. So what I would do is get my tape recorder, and then I would set up all my sound effects stuff, and then I would literally read the book. And I would do the voices and then hear the footsteps and do the things and do the door. I would do these little radio play things. It was really fun to do. And they're awful, but it was, I remember I loved doing that so much. That was as a kid, I spent.
What could
that's
be better?
So cool. I love the idea of you sitting there just moving stuff around.
Oh my God. I loved it so much. I don't know. And it was always, I don't know. There was something about audio, just the only audio, which I just.
I know. Well, I mean, loved. I interviewed so many people. I wrote a book about this, mm-hmm. and I interviewed so many people and things you don't think about. I interviewed the sound effects guys, and they would say, all right, in the script, there's a knock on the door. All right. Is it an urgent knock?
What kind of knock?
Yeah, what kind of knock?
Is it a casual knock? Okay. Is it an insistent knock?
You're good at that. You've practiced.
But I mean, that's just it. I mean, it's part of the drama.
Yes.
If you don't understand what kind of knock it is, you're not going to do it right.
No, those guys were actors as well. That's right. They couldn't just be doing sounds. They had to be actors, too.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh,
well. All right. Now, I guess we have to get onto other things now, huh? Okay.
We'll keep coming back to it somehow.
Okay.
We'll connect it the whole way.
All right. Well, to go from an old entertainment medium, which has not yet died because it's still alive, to a new entertainment medium, relatively new, video games, you really made your reputation writing music for video games.
I did.
And that was a job that didn't exist.
No, it didn't exist.
25 years ago, 30 years ago.
It was a job that at the time, I was working at Disney Interactive. Mm-hmm. I had been working in marketing for the previous 3-4 years as an assistant at Disney, both Disney and Universal. And a job opened up at Disney Interactive, and I interviewed for it, and I got the job as an assistant producer. Because I was, all that time in marketing, it all taught me, the producers hire the composers. And I remember when that job came up, I thought, well, then maybe I can, sort of get in that way, learn what it's like to be a producer, and then when they need music, I could offer my services up myself. I'll be in the middle of it. And that's pretty
You're
much the way it played out.
You're an evil genius.
That's the way
you
it played
You are an
out.
Evil genius.
Well, at the time I got there, they were growing. They needed a sound studio. And I was like, I know how to do that. I can build that. And so they had me. So I built a music studio there, which was great. And they were like, so you can write music? I was like, yeah, I can do all. So when they get into a jam with something, oh, God, we need a piece of music for this presentation or this, they would say, Michael, can you do this? And then little by little, they gave me more and more and more to do. And so
now, was this all on a synthesizer?
At that time, it was all on a synthesizer. Mm-hmm. To be specific, there were JV 1080s, JV 880s. These were Roland machines, sort of they were very old school, but they did the job.
Sure.
And at that time, you had Nintendo and Sega. So and both of those, you couldn't do live music on those because they were all driven by these very, very, very tiny memory chips. This phone here has more memory on it than probably 1,000 Nintendo, chips had at the time. And those chips had more information on it than what the guys took to go to the moon on. So, I mean, so you see how it grows over the years. But that's where it all started. And I worked on a game called Maui Mallard I did the music for. I worked on some of the music for the Lion King video game. I ended up producing most of that with Jeff Rona was a composer who worked with Hans Zimmer, who sort of did a lot of that music for that video game.
So, like when I played on my Sega, the Lion King game, that was you?
I produced that. I would say mostly that was Jeff.
Let's just say it was you.
But if you played Maui Mallard, or if you played, which was actually a great game, so if you still have a Sega Genesis,
I have my Sega.
Find a Maui Mallard
game.
That was a really cool
game.
That was really fun. It was sort of Maui Mallard in noir detective mode. Mm. It was a Donald Duck as playing Maui Mallard, like a Sam Spade type of guy, and it was fantastic. So that's where I cut my teeth in doing music for those video games, and then when I left Disney, I started my own with another guy. I started an animation company, essentially. And we had about 30 people working for us, and we were doing animation for DreamWorks Interactive. DreamWorks had just started. Jeffrey Katzenberg, who I knew through my boss in marketing, was heading it up, as you know. And so I called him up, and I was like, hey, I'm ready for a change. If you need any help over at DreamWorks, I'm happy. And he was like, yeah, he called me back. And before you knew it, we had our own small studio set up to help them produce some animation for the games and come up with ideas for future products and all that. So I ran.
Now, were these tied to DreamWorks animated features?
Yeah. Well, at the time, it was a mix. They didn't really, you know, they were just starting out. So yeah. so they didn't have a whole lot.
Prince of Egypt game, I don't think it sold too well.
Yeah, no, okay. I didn't work on that. We were mostly working on a game called Someone's in the Kitchen, which was basically a cooking game that kids could, you know, if you want to, you know, online, you know, bake a cake, you can do it in this game and the whole thing. So we were doing all the animation for that. We were also doing the animation for another game called Chalk Talk. Neither of these things were great, but it was fun work, and I got to work with a lot of guys who are still my friends today and amazing animators and artists. And I sort of ran the creative of that studio for about a year and a half before that fell apart, because it's, you know, running your own animation studio is incredibly hard, and it's not, you know, to keep that going financially, it's really tough.
It's a lot.
So we sort of got absorbed into DreamWorks itself, some of us, and I ended up at DreamWorks Interactive as a producer, and I was finishing up those games there when one of the other teams was working on a game called The Lost World, and that was at the same time that they were filming The Lost World. Steven Spielberg was directing it, and they had a big meeting coming up. And they said, hey, can we need music for this thing. We have this animation we're going to show, and we want to put some new music behind it before we show Steven tomorrow. And I was like, okay. And and my friend Patrick Gilmore, who was one of the producers on the game, said, you know, can you have it by tomorrow? And I was like, sure. So I went home. I wrote a piece of music for it. They put it in. He really liked it. And I went about my business that day. You know, they had their big meeting with Steven Spielberg, which I was not invited to, downstairs. And I sort of forgot about it, as I was working on this other game. And about 11 o'clock or so that morning, I get a phone call from Patrick saying, hey, you know, Steven wants to talk to you. Can you come down? And I was like, Steven who? Because I was like, my head was just somewhere else. And he's like, Steven Spielberg, our boss, you know, the guy that signs our checks. I was like, oh, really? Okay. So, and it was this weird moment because we were in this building in Bel Air at the time, and to get to the top floor or the bottom floor, there was an escalator. So I remember running to the escalator because I kept thinking in my head, he's probably just going to leave. If I don't get down there soon, he's just going to leave, you know? So I ran to the top of the escalator, and I looked down at the bottom, and there he was standing at the bottom of the escalator. And I had this crisis in my head all of a sudden, like, I'm at an escalator. Do I walk down the stairs or do I just get on the escalator and let it take me to him?
And slowly.
Yes. What do I do? So I ended up choosing, I'm just going to stand like a normal person, not seem too eager. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to allow myself just to go down the escalator towards him. And as it's going down, he's standing down there waiting. I'm going down this thing, getting closer to him. And I was thinking to myself, this is so weird. This is like a shot out of one of his movies where the camera is just going in, right in on his face, you know? And that's literally what was going through my head as I was getting close. And then he reached, put his hand out, and he said, Michael, he goes, I just want to tell you how much I love the music that you wrote for that piece of animation. And you're going to be doing the whole game, right? And I thought, yeah, I'm sure. And I had been, and the funny thing is, up to that point, I had been trying to get the guys who are running DreamWorks Interactive to do live orchestras, mm-hmm. because you were just now able to do what they call Red Book audio, which is just a recording, you know, a WAV file or something. You could record anything you want and put it on the PlayStation DVD. So it could actually play like a CD quality music, which they hadn't been able to do before. So I had been telling you guys, we should record this stuff with live orchestras. We could put them in, and they're like, we are not paying for live orchestra. This game's as expensive already as it is, and we're not going to do that, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, they were standing with Steven at the bottom of that escalator when he said to me, so you're going to do the game, right? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'm doing the game. And the two guys, the CEO and the CFO, were looking at me like, okay. And then Steven goes, and of course, we have to do it with a live orchestra. We have to do it with a live orchestra because it's the only way it's going to sound right. And I was like, I agree. And Steven's like, so you already planning to do that? And I said, yeah. And one of the guys said, yeah, Michael's putting together a budget for that as we speak. And I was like, yeah, I'm putting together a budget as we speak. And Steven's like, yes, because, you know, in Steven's world, that's...
Well, but he's the guy who brought orchestral music back to animation on television.
Yes,
with
exactly.
Tiny Toons.
Yes.
And animated
God bless him. Because, yes. I mean, it makes a huge huge difference.
Yeah.
So because of those words that he probably doesn't even realize he said, doesn't he? That literally changed, that second right there changed the trajectory of my entire career. Mm-hmm. Because up to then it was all synthesizing me just wishing I could work with live musicians, you know? And but after he said that, that was it.
Wow. So how did you approach – well, I mean, that's a nice thing, and you had a musical education, and you're a smart guy, and you've been listening intently under your pillow.
Yes.
to music scores. So you had absorbed a lot.
Yes.
But still, how do you approach for the first time preparing to – write for and then conduct.
You know, it's I attribute a lot of it to the foolishness of youth.
There you go.
You know, where you're just like, sure, I can do that, and you don't even care if you can or can't. You'll figure it out somehow. You know, and that's essentially what it was. And I was so excited just to have the opportunity to do it. And I don't remember ever being incredibly nervous about it. I remember just having a lot of fun doing it, you know, and being able to write melodically. And, you know, I had spent some time at Juilliard, and the last thing that they wanted you to do was to write melodically. That was literally, so it was like being in a Catholic school with the nun slapping her hand with the ruler. Anything that even resembled a melody, get that out of here, you know? And I was like, guys, I want to work on film scores. You got to give me some leeway here.
They wanted you to sound like John Cage and have like big wooden blocks.
Yes, exactly.
Pounding the piano.
Yes. Okay, if there was a tonal sense to your piece, then you were wrong.
Okay.
You know, it couldn't be that. It needed to be something that people cringed at or something that hurt your ears. Then you were doing it right, you know? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I got to UCLA when I left New York City that suddenly I was in these classes where, oh, it is okay to learn how to do this. It is okay. They encouraged it. They want it a lot. They want it. So, you know, everything was different then. But so that all being said, it was one of those situations where I was like, okay, we couldn't do it in town. It was too expensive to do in town. And they didn't, and, you know, there were a few things that they were just insisting on. It couldn't be union, all of this stuff. So we had to do it in Seattle with guys who would play with the Seattle Symphony. And I remember Simon James was the first violinist, the concert master, and he was also the contractor, so he got the orchestra together. And he was fantastic. And we went up there and we did this. We recorded it, brought it back, and we put it in the game. Now, at that time also, the music didn't really change with the action that was going on. It was just music played behind whatever it was you were doing. So I remember, I think there were like 19 or 20 pieces of music that I did, and they were maybe 2 minutes each. So it would just loop behind those things. But, you know, I'll never forget being up there with that orchestra and thinking, there were things that I wrote that I thought would be right, and all of a sudden when they were playing it, they were not playing it right, and nothing was right. And I was like, I learned a lot in that first 20 minutes of that session. I learned so much that I still carried with me to today, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the nice thing about this job, you're just constantly learning. But I remember there was moments of panic and moments of joy and moments of, and when it was all over, I was exhausted, and it was just like, I can't believe that just happened, you know. And I thought, maybe this is it, maybe I'll never get to do this again. But boy, that was fun, you know. And then they started making more video games. A friend of mine, Peter Hirschman, still one of my best friends today, he worked on a game called Medal of Honor. And after I did Lost World, you know, they had asked, would you do this Medal of Honor game? Now, you know, Steven worked on Lost World while he was directing Lost World. He was overseeing the production of Medal of Honor while he was shooting Saving Private Ryan, you know. So, and the thing about Steven was it was so important to him that we all understood not just what we were doing, but what he was doing, what he wanted to do with Saving Private Ryan. What was important to him was that people, for lack of a better word, experienced what it, as close as they could in a film setting, what it was really like for these guys. It was not to be a heroic adventure. It was to be something serious. And he kept saying, is there any way we can do that in a video game? How can we get that idea across in a video game? And one of the things was, musically, we just wanted it to be very serious. We didn't want everything to feel like, yeah, you're on an adventure to kill the bad guys. You know, that's not what it was about for us. It was about, you know, it is a game, so you do have to enjoy the process. But hopefully when you walk away from a game like Medal of Honor, you also have then carry away an interest to learn more about the subject matter you just participated in. Mm. And that was important to us. And one of the things we wanted to do was make it emotional, you know, and so there are moments in the score which are just really somber and emotional, playing against really intense combat scenes. And we're trying to do things. It wasn't out of a need to do something that no one had ever done before. It was out of a need to trigger something emotionally, both within ourselves and hopefully then within the player as well. It's one of my favorite things I've ever worked on, and it's there. I still remember letters I would get from people saying, you know, thanking us. And wow. To me in particular, I would get these letters saying, you know, I listened to your music with my grandfather. And he had never spoken of his time in the war before until then. And then as we were listening to the music together, he started telling me all these stories. And it was, you know, and that's like one letter out of many. You get a lot of these letters and they're very emotional. And you're just like, you don't even realize what you're doing. You're trying to get this work done. You're trying to do all this stuff. And you don't always think about the impact it has on the people out there in the world that take it in.
Stephen foresaw that,
yes.
The potential.
Yes. Yeah.
That's why he's a great storyteller.
He is the best storyteller. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, he's really fun to listen to, fun to work with, and he listens, and he's got, you know, he's a fountain of ideas all the time. But what I loved so much about that was how important it was that us guys off to the side of what he was doing, which is this massive movie, mm-hmm. with Tom Hanks and all that, how important it was for him that we also were down in the trenches, mm-hmm. understanding exactly what it was like to be one of the guys that, say, Tom was playing or any of the other great actors in that film. And he went so far as to have us spend a couple days with Captain Dale Dye, you know, training us. He took us out into this paintball camp out in past Valencia or something.
And to interrupt, Dale Dye is the go-to guy.
Yeah.
He's the most famous military consultant in Hollywood.
Yep.
Is he a Marine?
Marine, I believe, yeah.
And so he's the real deal.
Oh, an incredible guy. And, you know, we thought, oh, we're going out to paintball. This is going to be fun. It wasn't fun. It was scary because he put you in a place and a time and a frame of mind which made you understand that you're not here to have fun. You're here because you're responsible for the guy on either side of you. Mm-hmm. You're not responsible for responsible for them. You all have to be responsible for each other. And it was the most intense day I have ever spent. You know, by the time we were actually ready to go and play one of the war games, it was like you were just thinking, okay, this is so important. I have to do this right, and I have to make sure that I'm taking care of the guys to my left and my right. And we all had to learn how to signal each other and talk to each other without talking, and he would send us on raids, and they would split us up into squads. The whole thing, it was an incredible experience that I will never, ever, ever forget. But all those little things that they did for us really helped us understand what we were doing better and helped us make a better game, which we made, I think, you know, four of those Medal of Honor things together. And it was, again, another experience which sent me on this other whole path. And really, look, I've always been sort of an emotional person. I tend to really get I'm really drawn in by emotional stories. But one of the things I think, you know, Stephen taught us then was just how important that was. I always did it just naturally, but now I understood why it was so important in telling stories, and it made me look at all his work that he had done in a totally different way, completely different way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I just have this image in my head of you getting splattered with like neon paintballs going, I just want to write the music. Yeah. I just want to write the music.
Yeah, pretty. I think I ended up doing okay. I think I ended up, I think in the second round I got killed. But I think I made it through the first one. And there's barracks and things and houses you had to hide in, and you had to clear rooms, and you didn't know who was in them. So you were it was scary. Oh,
wow. We saw Steven Spielberg at the Oscar nominee luncheon.
Uh-huh.
It was one of the last times we saw you.
Right.
And I've been near him, but I never said anything to him. And my mom goes, Jesse, he looks like a rabbi. You just go over, you say hi. It's very easy. It's very nice. And so I said to my dad, I'm like, I think I was like, I'm ready.
Yeah.
And he was so nice, but that almost overwhelmed me more.
He's a wonderful guy.
And hi, Steven Spielberg. How
I
you doing,
that.
Buddy?
Well,
I'm so nervous.
Hey, I've been there. I remember that first day. You know, I remember, you know, and But the thing is, what you get from him is you understand, look, he just loves what he does. He loves it. He loves it. And that's what it's all about to him. Yeah. This is not a money-making venture. It's not a – he just loves doing this. Yeah. He loves telling stories.
And so do you.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. I love it so much.
So how'd you get your first TV gig?
Well, through Stephen in a way, because Stephen, after those games, he was so generous, and he would recommend me for things. Mm-hmm. And he would say, hey, you know, there was a TV show called High Incident that they were producing at the time. So I got to, you know, I would always end up demoing for things because he would, you know, and I think, you know, a lot of times people would say, okay, we got to listen to this Yahoo's music now because
our boss Spielberg
told
says
us
I
to.
Have
so,
to.
And I'm sure that must have, you know, annoyed a bunch of people. But he would always try to open these doors for me, and including my agent, Mike Gorfain, who was John Williams' agent, has been John's agent for many years, and many other people's agents. He's, you know, worked with Jerry Goldsmith, all these great people. Anyway, Mike and Sam Schwartz, they've been around a long time. And I was at this point in my career where I was doing a lot of video games, and I really wanted to do television. And you know, and even with some of the introductions that Stephen had made at the time, they didn't really pan out for me. But he said, I got a call. I was sitting there in my office, and I was sort of depressed and thinking, like, how can I get into TV? Because every time I try to get into TV, they would say, oh, you just do video games. You don't understand how to do television. And I'm like, no, it's not that. I can do that. I can, you know, but no one wanted to hear that. And then forget even talking about movies. That wasn't even, you know, that was a non-starter at that time for me. So I got a call one day as I was sitting here kind of thinking about all this. And it was from Susan Ray, who works with Stephen. She goes, hey, I'm on the stage with Stephen right now, and he was wondering if it would be okay if he gave your phone number to Mike Gorfain, who represents John Williams. He would like to meet with you. He's been telling Stephen about you all morning. I mean, he's been telling Mike about you all morning. And I thought, sure, that's fine with me. Okay. And I was like, I can't believe that just happened. I said, he'll never call me. He'll never call. It'll just be like one of those things. Oh, yeah, I'll talk to him. And then literally the next morning, Mike called me and said, hey, I was with Stephen yesterday. Would you be interested in coming in? We could meet and talk about things. And I was like, yeah. So I went in, and that was – when was that? That was like 1999, I think. And I've been with Mike ever since then and joined those guys pretty much that next day after that meeting. So Stephen has been incredibly – supportive all the way. And so then, okay, Medal of Honor games start going out into the world. People are playing them. There's this writer. His name is Jesse Alexander. Such a good guy. And look him up because he's worked on so many great things. Jesse brought these video game soundtracks to JJ. Jesse and JJ were best friends. And so
J.J.
Abrams, yes.
Just to be clear.
Do you even need to say Abrams
just
anymore?
Just to be crystal, clear.
I think it's like saying Santa.
Yeah, it is.
You don't need to say Claus, right?
Claus.
I think it's like it's very similar. Now, right. You know, that's
Santa
he's taken
Santa
on
Speederman.
That sort of, you
it's
know.
Santa Speederman. Lovely
yeah,
guy.
Yes,
lovely
exactly.
guy.
Yeah. So Jesse gave these CDs to J.J. and said, hey, listen to these. And J.J. really enjoyed, really liked the CDs. And then I got this email again, one of those days where I was sitting there sort of depressed, thinking I'm never going to get into be able to make this next leap. And I get an email from a guy named JJ Abrams, who I had never heard of. And it just said, hey, I had a little website up at the time, michaelgiacchino.com, and you were able to email me directly. And he said, hi, my name is JJ Abrams. I co-created Felicity. And I wrote Armageddon and Regarding Henry, and I'm working on a new show with ABC, and I'm wondering if you would be available to come in and talk about working on it with me. And I was like, first of all, I thought, this is a joke. This is one of my friends screwing with me, and I'm going to beat the crap out of them when I find out who it is, because this is just not nice. You know, so I remember bringing it in and showing it to my wife at the time, and she said, I said, do you think this is real? Should I call? She goes, well, call it and find out.
Yeah.
So I called the number, and it was JJ. And he's like, yeah, can you come? I loved your video game music. I've been listening to it. And I was wondering if you'd want to, you know, come in and meet about working on this show I'm doing called Alias. And I was like, sure. So, okay. So I go in, and it was, I think it was the day before they were going to start shooting the pilot. And he's having this meeting with me, but at the same time, people keep coming in. This woman keeps coming in, and every time she's in a different costume, and they're trying to get approvals. And he introduces me to her. Hey, Michael, this is Jennifer Garner. And I was like, oh, hi, Jennifer, you know, Michael. And I didn't know who she was. I never watched at the time Felicity, so I didn't know any of these.
Sure.
And so she came in, and Bradley Cooper kept coming in. And I remember there was one thing about his hair. They're like, no, the hair's not right. I think it needs it. JJ would give the comments, and then they would go out. And it was really like this strange meeting because all of this was going on, and we were talking, and we just got along really quickly, really fast. He also is a musician. He loves writing. He loves electronic music, especially in so he's really into all that. So we had a lot to talk about. And he would show me all his gear that he had, and we were in between people coming in and out. And it was just a really – I remember leaving there thinking, that was really fun. That was just really fun. Like if work could always just be like that, that would be fantastic. So before you know it, I'm on the show. I'm working on it. And I'm all going to the set, and I'm visiting, and I'm watching them do everything because I just love filmmaking in general. It's mm-hmm. All I did growing up was make movies. So like this was like a joy for me to be a part of. And there it was, once again, another sort of weird, you know, turn in life that then just sets you on this whole other trajectory.
Did you have to utter the words to him, and I want to use the live orchestra?
I said that to him, and he was like, I agree. We should absolutely do that. And he went to bat with the studio for that because, of course, they were – you know, the last thing anyone wants these days is to have to pay for musicians.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so infuriating. But that's a whole nother topic. Anyway, yeah. But he went to ABC, and they, to their credit, they said, absolutely, yeah, sure. So because he wanted it, and they, you know, mm-hmm. wanted to be in business with him. And he's just a nice, smart guy, too. I like to think a lot of it is that. And we got our musicians. We would have like maybe 35 players per session, mm-hmm. you know, so it's not a huge orchestra, but it's a nice size orchestra, and mm-hmm. it's actually more in line with what they used to do all the time in old television and even the radio shows.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think the original King Kong was only like 36 to 38 players. There wasn't a whole lot of players mm-hmm. there, but mm-hmm. you know, there it is on how you orchestrate.
Yeah.
So I set up an orchestra that wasn't a full orchestra. I didn't want a real full thing. So I wanted strings, and I think for Alias, it was strings, horn, harp, a percussion, a piano, electric bass. And I think that was it. That was the orchestra through the whole run.
Keytar.
No keytar.
Damn
no.
It.
I thought about it. The guy was too expensive at the time. Yes. You know.
Damn the studios
doubles.
And their budgets.
Yes. So we did that, and that was Alias. And then, of course, Alias. Then the next weird turn happened in my career, which was I'd been working with them on Alias. I think we had just about were getting ready to start on Lost when I got a call. Well, let me back up a little bit. Prior to that, I have a good friend of mine, Teddy Newton, who's an artist and a story guy and an animator, worked at on Iron Giant with Brad Bird years ago.
We love them.
Oh, Brad's the best, right? Come on. Yeah. That's a whole nother, again, whole nother thing.
You've got all your Iron Giant toys.
Yes,
in his office.
As you should. It's a beautiful movie. And I remember at the time, Teddy called me. He goes, oh, you should be working on this movie, because he was working on Iron Giant. He goes, you should be on this movie. You do a great job on this movie. And of course, I hadn't done anything at that point, really, that anyone would consider me, take me seriously. And Michael Kamen was working on the film, and Michael Kamen was fantastic. And so Brad... you know, so anyway, Teddy, I remember mentioning that. So I knew Teddy, so I had this real, very thin connection to Brad Bird. I'd never met him at the time. So years later, after I go do Alias and after I kind of about to start Lost, and I'm in the Disney fold somewhat because ABC and Disney was producing those two shows, I got a call about this movie called The Incredibles. And they were like, hey, would you be able to meet with Brad Bird? Now, how that call came about, depending on who you talk to, is slightly different story. But the story I know is that my friend Teddy, who I was just telling you about, he had moved up to work at Pixar because Brad took a bunch of the guys from Iron mm-hmm. Giant, mm-hmm. moved up to Pixar to take on this crazy film called
The
Incredibles.
Which is in Northern California.
Northern California, yep, in Emeryville, outside of San Francisco. And so Teddy had been working on this film. And again, Teddy called me and was like, oh, you would be great at this. You should do this movie. But they have this guy named John Barry. He's already signed on to do it. And, you know, John was originally going to do it. And, you know, Brad wanted a very specific sound for this film. And he wanted it to feel like one of those old James Bond movies. Mm-hmm. He wanted that orchestral jazz orchestra from the, you know, 60s, early 70s that mm-hmm. you just don't get anymore. When's the last time you've seen or heard that in a movie? You know, you don't get it anymore. And they worked with John for a little bit. But I guess John, you know, John had done all that. He's yeah. like, I did that. I created that, you know. and I feel like he just didn't want to revisit that. Wasn't yeah. interested in revisiting that, yeah. you know. And you know, we all get there at a certain point in our life, right? Is someone you've done enough of one thing, and people ask you, that's all you're known for.
He's an artist, and he has yes. evolved, and he doesn't want to go back and copy himself.
Exactly, and thank God, because. If he had been all for doing that, I would not be sitting with you here today. So, you know, when that sort of didn't work out, they had to look elsewhere. And so they said, hey, we have this upstart here who's, you know, been working with us in the music department. So the music department could vouch for me at Disney. And they said, you know, and what Teddy did in the meantime was also give a lot of my music to Steve Schaefer, the editor of The Incredibles. And Steve would start putting that into the cut as they would start working. Huh. And Brad would be like, well, what is that? I never heard that before. And Steve's like, oh, that's some one of Teddy's friends. I just used it. He gave me some, you know. So Teddy snuck it in there in a very kind of smart way. And then Brad was like, well, we should meet with him. Why don't we meet with him? Let's meet. And that's how that – I get called up. I fly up to Pixar, spend the day with Brad. And I remember the thing that sort of like – just solidified it for our relationship was the fact that I was like, I started talking about Johnny Quest and how much I loved Johnny Quest, you know, and Hoyt Curtin, you know, one mm-hmm. of the and Brad just went berserk. Johnny Quest, I love Johnny Quest. Johnny Quest was my favorite as a kid because had everything you wanted in an animated, you know, an animated show, had action, had drama. It was had amazing, you know, all like we just went off and we had this whole thing about Johnny Quest and the music and all of that, you know, and I loved that music. I mean, I was obsessed with that. I was obsessed with a lot of things growing up, and I carry them all forward with me into the things I do today. And so that just – and he was like, all right, man, all right, why don't you take home a couple scenes from the film, put some music to it, and then we can – you know, he wasn't ready to say it's yours, mm-hmm. but he was ready to say take a few scenes and let's see what you do with them.
Yeah.
And those were like – I remember that was a horrifyingly, you know, just a tense time for me because I'm writing this and I'm thinking – because I wanted to do that movie so bad.
Sure.
I wanted to do it so bad. And I wrote these – I even paid to have musicians actually play on it because, you know, that kind of music is impossible to really mock up properly on a synthesizer. It sounds yeah. like total crap and it's not good. So I thought, oh, the only way to do this, I'm going to have to pay – to do, you know, which is fine. I got Capitol Records. I got a bunch of musicians that had been playing on Alias.
Capitol Records has.
I was going to say settle.
For those who are not here, for you listeners who are not here in LA, Capitol Records, which has that iconic building that looks like a stack of records
yep.
on Vine Street, has the most famous and desirable recording studio in town.
Oh, it's incredible. Frank Sinatra recorded there, you know, Dean Martin. I mean, everyone. It's just an incredible place. So we recorded there, and there was like, you know, we did like maybe six minutes of music. I did mm-hmm. like a little demo for what could be a theme. I did one of the scenes where you know, a couple of random scenes. And then I remember I handed everything in, and then they were going to come down to my house and watch it at my house. Now, that's at this time, I had just moved into this house in Encino. I was trying to build a studio above the house. So in the meantime, I was working in this tiny little room that was – it's smaller than this room we're in now. And
hard to believe.
Quite small.
And so there were folding chairs. I had folding chairs. I had my music desk, which was pretty big because of the keyboard and everything. And I remember Brad came – the head of music, Chris Montan, and John Walker came. John Walker produced the film. And they came, and they're sitting in these little folding chairs in this tiny room listening to these demos and everything. And they're like, oh, that's great. Thanks so much, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it did, the meeting didn't end with you got the job. It just ended. You know, mm-hmm. it was nice. It was good. They went back to Northern California, and like a week goes by, and I don't hear anything. And during all this, I had sort of become friendly with Lori Richardson, who was Brad's assistant at the time. So I kept emailing her. So, Lori, what's up? Anything? And she would be like,
hey, buddy.
Sorry, nothing. And, you know, nothing yet. And then I think it was about, you know, 10 days later, I thought, oh, well, I didn't get it. The phone rings. It's Brad. And he's like, all right, man, listen, you got the job. But, he goes, it's going to be the hardest job of your life, you know? And I was like, okay, that's fine. I'm up for that. And he goes, no, what I mean is your music could completely ruin my movie. And I was like, all right, that's not the sentence I thought you were going to say, but okay. Okay, why? And he's like, because if you and I aren't hand in hand telling the exact same story every frame of this film, the audience is going to start thinking things we don't want them thinking, and we can't have that. So if we're going to do this together, we're going to do it as a partnership, and we're going to make this perfect, you know, which I was like, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's like, I wouldn't want it any other way. That was the beginning of our relationship, that conversation. And we have since become just, you know, he is one of my best friends. He is such an amazing guy, and I look up to him immensely, and as does most of the world, because the films he makes are just they're incredibly emotional, they're thoughtful, they're not too fastly, too quickly paced. They allow breathing room, and you know, we could go on and on and on about his films, but again, you know, that path of that weird path of the video games to being able to work with JJ, who is just this incredible filmmaker, being able to work with Brad, who's another incredible filmmaker. I mean, they've just been really, I don't even know
and
how
Steven.
It all happened. And then, well, it all started with Steven. Yes, it all started with Steven. And after years of working with him and then finally doing the movie Super 8 with JJ, you know, and Steven's producing this movie, right. And I remember thinking, this is insane. What happened? I must have been much better than I was in this life in a previous life, because there's some payback happening.
Did you make home movies as a kid too?
That's all I ever did. I still have every one of them, you know, mm-hmm. and they're lengthy too. Like some of them are an hour long, some of them, you know.
An hour long?
Oh yeah. Like as I got into high school, I started making ones that actually have full on stories that were an hour long, you know, or, you know, it would go from anywhere 40 minutes to an hour, depending on the film. But I have tons of smaller ones too, and a lot of it was stop motion animation. Mm-hmm. And then I graduated into Chris, you know, roping all my friends into being actors and doing mm-hmm. that. And we would do all kinds of things. Most of them were originals, but occasionally I'd do like, let's recreate the bike chase from E.T. This morning I had just found in my closet this little armature that I had built of Elliot riding his bike with the E.T. basket, because I was building it to use to do a visual effects shot. I never got to do that shot, but I still have the armature, and I just today put it up in my office.
Oh, my.
And it's really
crazy.
Have
you seen Be Kind, Rewind?
I haven't.
Okay. The short reason I bring it up is because they accidentally erase half of the videos that they have in the video store.
The story of
so
that.
They have
yes.
to try and recreate
so they do, yes.
all
that's
these
cool,
scenes
what we even do.
From
yes.
movies. And yep. that's immediately what I imagine somebody going, if Blockbuster were alive, going to Blockbuster and getting E.T. and it's just you with this little armature.
It's a film.
Come on.
I really wish I had felt. I'm thinking like maybe
you
I should
can.
Just do it now.
You still
I still
can.
Have my old camera. They'll still do the film processing. But I shot the whole scene with the kids on the bikes and the cars chasing them and all of that, but I never got to the flying part. Was always a little tricky to figure out how to do, you know. I don't know. It's a weird, weird life.
So you were in New Jersey,
yeah.
and you went to Juilliard.
Well,
first
I went to School of Visual Arts.
Yeah, School of Visual
That's
Arts.
That's where I went to film school. Graduated from School of Visual Arts. Right out of film school, went to work for Disney in their marketing department, where I had a boss named Michael Scrimenti, who was saying, you know, he knew I wanted to do music. He knew that. And he was just like, you know, Juilliard's right down the street. You should go take classes. And I was like, I can't, because I'm working here during the day. How am I going to do that? And Michael said, look, he goes, I love what I do. He loved marketing. He loved working in publicity. He goes, you know, this is fun for you, but this is not what you should be doing with your life. So you need to get that part of your life progressed as well. So go take classes. He goes, I'll cover for you here. We're 3 hours behind. They're 3 hours behind us. They're not, they don't know what's going on here, you know, out in LA. He's like, so go take a couple hours off every day and come in early on those days or stay later and you can make up for it. But then Disney also, because I had no money, I had nothing. Disney at the time had this program where if you wanted to take continuing education, they would pay for it as long as it related to whatever your job was.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So he wrote up this whole thing how me taking these music classes would help my marketing job and all of that. And
that's a generous gesture.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I still talk to Michael today. I just saw him a couple months ago, actually in February. Mm-hmm. He lives in Arizona now, but. He incredible people. I was blessed to have really wonderful people that I worked with. Him, both him, Gary Kalkin, who was a senior vice president of marketing at Disney, mm-hmm. under Bob Levin, who was there at the time, mm-hmm. and I worked with Terry Press, mm-hmm. and you know all these people who were just incredibly supportive in a town in which you're told is not supportive. In a town, as you grow up, you hear is the worst place in the world to live.
Yeah.
And everyone's mean to each other. And it's,
I know. I don't agree with that. And I know that there are people who have that experience.
Yes. And I don't want to discount that because it is out there. But guess what? It's like anywhere else. Anywhere. They have their good and their bad.
Yeah.
And I found out here more of the good.
Yeah. You know? And I think that has to do a lot, my theory, with you.
Of course.
I mean, or with other people who've had, I mean, I've had the same kind of life. I've had mostly positive experiences.
Yeah.
I've had very few sour experiences, very few.
Yep.
And whether it's just people say, all the people I've interviewed, how many crummy interviews, very few.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe, you know, maybe it's something I give off to them. You radiate enthusiasm, Michael. You it's just obvious. It's obvious you love what you do. It's obvious you enjoy life, and so for someone not to respond to that would be odd.
Yeah,
not impossible.
Certainly not impossible.
Not impossible.
I've run into him,
but yeah,
no,
not again.
Now, one time I saw you at a screening at a big press screening for Let Me In.
Okay, yeah.
Which I thought was a terrific movie.
Reeves. Yeah.
Well, I thought the Swedish original was extraordinary, and this is the best translation I'd ever seen of a foreign language film into a Hollywood movie by Matt Reeves.
Yep.
Let Me In. And I saw you, and at the time you said that I don't do R-rated movies.
Yeah, I know.
And
it's a funny story, actually.
So would you elaborate on that?
Yes, because Matt, who I'm working with right now, actually, on War for the Planet of the Apes, mm-hmm. Matt is, you know, I always say Matt, there's a lot of directors in town, but Matt's a filmmaker. You know, mm-hmm. Matt is like this incredible artist, and not that everyone else isn't, but you know, this is he just approaches it from this whole other angle. Everyone is very different. And Matt, you know, I did Cloverfield for Matt. Now, mm-hmm. Cloverfield had no music in it. So I remember telling JJ, well, you got it. What are you going to do? You got to have something in the end credits. I said, why don't you let me write? Because I love monster movies. I love like Godzilla and Ultraman and all of this stuff. I love it. So I said, why don't you let me write the music that would have been in the movie? And for the end credits, we'll just do a whole suite. And JJ was like, perfect, let's do that. So I did that for Matt. And that was Matt and I's first time working together. And we had a great time. And it was just a short-lived thing because it was just at the end of the production. So then he calls me and goes, hey, I'm doing this movie, you know, called Let Me In. It's about this little girl's a vampire and it's a horror movie. And I was like, yeah, no, I don't want to. I don't like bloody movies. Like growing up, I was not into things like Friday the 13th or, you know, even like Freddy Krueger and stuff like that. Like anything that has where the cast is all about killing each other and ripping off limbs and things like that. I'm not into that. Didn't like it. Never did. I didn't even like looking at magazines like Fangoria, you know, things like that because it just freaked me out.
Yeah.
Didn't like it. And Matt's like, no, you have to just come see it. Come see it. I'm like, Matt, I don't think it's a good idea. And I protested as much as I could before he dragged me in to his edit suite and said, you have to. I'm making you watch this. Hmm. And I was like, okay. But I said, I felt so awful saying no to him because I loved Matt. I, you know, and,
sure.
and But I just knew that I wouldn't enjoy it. So I sat down, plays the movie for me, and I was like, oh, I get it. This is a Matt Reeves horror film. This is a Matt Reeves horror. This is an incredibly emotional and touching, beautiful story about these two kids and their friendship that develops. Mm-hmm. And then, but the horrible things that have to happen in order for that to sustain itself too. But done in a way which is so incredibly thoughtful and just beautiful. And I thought, oh, okay, yes, I'm in. And I often think about, God, what was I thinking? Like, I was so adverse to doing that kind of movie that I was just like, no, right up front without even seeing it. But, kudos to Matt for dragging my ass in there and sitting me down and making me watch it, because he did an incredible movie, and that's how I got onto that movie. So now I'm a little more open, I guess, when things come up.
I had the same feeling going in. First, seeing the Swedish movie, because I'm a wimp.
Yeah.
And I can't take that kind of graphic gore.
Do you remember? We watched it at home.
Yeah.
You and I watched it together. My mom didn't want to. Uh-huh. So the two of us sat there in our family room, dark. And the thing is, he jumps and I jump, but we tend not to jump at the same time. So it's one of those things where it was just like, squeeze, jump, squeeze,
then you're scaring
jump.
Each other.
Back and forth. But afterwards, both going, wow. So then hearing that they were going to do an American version, it was kind of like, oh, but...
But that was so perfect. Why would you ruin it? You know, I still... This is terrible. I still haven't seen the original. And no, I didn't see it at the time because I didn't want to be influenced.
No, it makes sense. It
makes perfect sense.
But I do want to.
But it really is arguably the best adaptation anyone's ever done of a foreign language film. They don't turn out too well very often.
No.
This one sure did. He did a great job.
He's great. And he allows you to be an artist as well. You know, it's not just him getting what he allows you to explore things and do things differently. And he's not expecting you to do what you would normally do in a film. And I look at everything. Everything is sad to me. You know, when I look at things, everything is sad to me. Everything, you know. And when this bottle of water is empty, I'll be like, oh, they're good. That water's going to miss its home. You know, it's like that. So when I look at these scenes, to me, so much of what was happening in that movie was incredibly sad.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and he allows me to go there. Like, even on like something like Planet of the Apes, where, you know, there's a lot of like fighting and all kinds of stuff. Like, I found so much of that movie very sad, and that's how I approach all of those things. And I don't know what it is.
I don't know. I hear the sad when I think about Ratatouille.
Yeah.
And films like that. They're especially when it's just violin moments. And I'm a sucker. I love music. I love music so much. And I'm surrounded by so many talented people. We're going to see Richard Sherman tonight.
Oh, you know, I love Richard. Please tell him hello. I miss him. I haven't seen him in a few months.
Richard did our podcast. And he said we were the first pod he ever casted. he's one of my favorite humans. But he has that too, which is he knows how to do something where I just start crying.
Yeah.
He'll play one chord and you go, oh, no.
And that's why I responded to Richard's stuff so much over the years as a kid and every growing up. Like, I loved how they weren't afraid to just be real, be emotional. Yeah. No, just put it out there.
Also, sweetness is not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing at all.
And that's very much, I think.
Because there's a difference between sweetness and being saccharine.
Yes, exactly.
And they know the difference.
Yes.
He and his brother.
Yep.
They knew, and he still knows the difference.
I agree. And that's really the trick, right? How do you stay honest?
Yeah.
If you're honest with your art, if you're honest, you can swallow almost anything.
Yeah.
Now you've
it's
done
when
something.
You're trying too hard.
You've done something now that the Shermans did long ago. You've written some theme park.
Yes,
ride
it's one
music.
Of my favorite things to do, actually, because I love the Disney parks. I love. If I could live in Adventureland, I would live in Adventureland.
I could see you living in Adventureland.
I literally go there and I'll be there at night wandering around and I will just wander around. I won't even go on anything. I just wander around. Like, I marvel at what they built
there. Why are you all in my house?
That would just be my whole life. And so I do love working for the parks, for the chance to get to be there. And I often think how lucky I am and how honored I am and able to say that, oh, that Up is playing on Main Street. Like, you walk down Main Street and they play Up. And that's so crazy to me that is there every day just playing, you know, or being able to do Space Mountain, which we got hijacked by Star Wars for a little while because everything gets hijacked by Star Wars. You know, because
wait a minute, didn't you just write the last Star Wars movie?
I did. I myself included was hijacked by Star Wars. Yes. So that's fine. That's fine. I love Star Wars. Full disclosure.
You have kids, right?
I have three kids.
You have three kids. How old?
19. 17 and 12.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, when they go to the park,
yeah,
did they think it's as cool as I think I would feel?
Look, if I'm taking them to the park, they don't care what reason we're going there. They're just happy to be going to the park, you know? If that's what gets us to the park more often, Daddy, keep doing that.
That's
you
so know? Funny.
Okay, yes. Good. That's the right attitude.
Do they like to watch what you do?
They do, actually. They do. They grew up coming to my sessions. They hang out there. They know a lot of the musicians now. In fact, my son, Mick, who is 19, he's at home right now. There was a small cue. Tomorrow is my last day of scoring for Spider-Man. And there was one small little cue at the very end that I forgot that I had to do. So I was like, oh, so I wrote it real quickly. And I thought, oh, Mick. I called Mick. I said, Mick, do you want to orchestrate this cue, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Now you have to understand, Mick has already he scored a movie for the Henson Company called Turkey Hollow, right? A good friend of mine, Kirk Thatcher, who has a bazillion great stories, and you will not regret inviting him on to talk one day. He's wonderful. But he has worked for years with the Muppets. He worked at ILM for many years in visual effects. He did work at Gremlins, all these things. Anyway, he was doing a movie for Henson called Henson and Lifetime, and they were doing it. It's called Turkey Hollow. So Kirk was at the Jurassic World recording sessions. He's come. My friends come. They hang out. We just whatever. And he's listening to this one cue. And you know when you go to a theme park, like we were just talking about, there's music playing in the background and all of that. Well, there was a couple of cues that needed to be written for when the boys are in the park and they're just talking and they're just waiting in line or whatever. So I had asked Mick, and you know, Jurassic World was three years ago, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And Mick was still in high school at the time. I said, do you want to write those cues? You know, there's two theme park things that are, you know, sort of adventurous. So he was like, yeah. So he wrote them, we recorded them. Kirk was there the day we were recording them. And Kirk's like, oh, I love that. That is awesome. What's that for? And I was like, Mick wrote that, I said, and it was for, you know, I explained what it was going to be used for. And he goes, you know, I have this movie I'm about to do. It's a TV movie. He goes, I know you're not going to do it. He said, but do you think he would be interested in doing it? And I was like, he's right. Go ask him. He's right over there. So he goes over to Mick, starts talking. And Mick has known Kirk for a bunch of years. You know, I've been friends with Kirk for a long time. And, he asked him, Mick, who's in high school, is just like, sure.
Right.
Very much in
just
the same
like
way. I was
just like
I don't know how I'm going to do it, but sure, I'll do it. So Mick wrote this score for this movie in his bedroom, and Kirk would come over and sit on the floor in his bedroom and
on
his little laptop, and they would review the cues and look at it like that.
Man.
And I remember, you know, Kirk would say, hey, can I come over today? And Mick would be like, well, you can't because I have to study. I have a test tomorrow.
I have a lot of homework, man.
I got homework, but can we do it tomorrow or something? So it was like this whole ridiculous thing. And it was great. It was just, you know, and it turned out really nicely. It was
how wonderful.
Really, really, really good.
Is that what he wants to do?
You know what? He loves music, and he plays piano, guitar, and he loves like Led Zeppelin and Queen and all. I mean, he loves all this great
good
stuff.
Good taste, yeah.
So right now he's just swimming in that world, playing with everything, doing it all, you know, trying to learn as much as he can. He's learning orchestration and all of those things. So he's just soaking it all up. But he loves the process of making movies very much like I did growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so my daughter, she loves music. She played guitar for a while, but she is much more into her academics. She's like probably the best student we've ever had in our family. She's like, you know, she's incredible. And she also is very much into last year. She went to Haiti and helped build a school there. She was raising money to help build schools in Haiti and water filtration. She is like doing all this really wonderful things, and she tutors kids who can't afford tutors, and she just does all this incredible. She's really wonderful. So she's the one I always joke, say, you know, when we're up trying to get through the gates of heaven and we're in the wrong line, but we're going to say, we're with her, though. We're with her. And they're going to be like,
she said it was cool. Yeah, she's going to follow her in. It's totally fine.
And then my 12-year-old is like, Nick, you know.
Is the 12-year-old a dud? Like
no,
really? This is ridiculous.
He's like incredible. He's also, he loves writing music, too. Like, he has a really good knack for melody and he wrote a very short cue for the first Planet of the Apes that I worked on, and then he did another one for this one, you know, and the director Matt was always so supportive. Yes, have him write it. If he wants to write it, let him write it. Oh, you know, great. And it's just like, you know, that's just it. Not unlike my parents, who whatever it was we were interested in as kids, I was interested in movies, my brother was interested in like history and archaeology, whatever it was, they fed us, you know. So whatever it is that's I've sort of taken that from my parents. So whatever the kids are really interested in, just keep helping them get in that direction. Push them in that direction.
Do you have like a Partridge Family bus yet? Of you performing?
We do have family band night every once in a while.
Of course you do.
We do that.
Speaking of family bands, one of the things that I admire most about you, there are many, but one of the things I admire most about you is that you make a point of hiring the oldest, most experienced musicians and collaborators.
Yes,
that you can.
We try to when and wherever possible. Absolutely, you know, they're getting harder and harder to find.
Yeah,
I'm sure. But I mean, there was a gentleman, one of my orchestrators, Tim Simonek, who I've worked with for so many years. Tim, such a great guy. Tim knew Jack Hayes. You know, and said, hey, we should have him work on one of our things. I was like, yeah, we should, you know. And I said, does he want to? He's like 90 years old. I was like, okay. You know, so we called him and asked him. And he said, sure. So Jack worked on several films with us. And he would have to do his orchestrations on paper as big as this table because his eyesight was pretty bad and it needed to be huge. So they would print up giant sheet music that he could do these. And I still have these. Oh, in my office that he did. And one of the cues that he orchestrated was the Married Life cue from Up. Mm-hmm. You know, so the
thing that makes us cry. Great.
Yes. Yes.
Great.
The scene that devastates people.
I can't keep watching the movie past that point.
Yes.
I watch it to there. I sob. I go to a corner.
And I feel so lucky to have been able to work with him on these things and learn. Every time you work with someone – like a master like that, you are just it's amazing. You look, it's like looking at something going, oh wait, but that seems so simple, and that just that I find that the smartest people, the most talented people, are able to distill things into the simplest form, you know, and make it sound complicated when it's literally not, you know. And looking at his orchestrations, I remember saying, talking to people on the stage, go, wait, there's no dynamics here. There's no this and that. And the players would be like, well, you don't need it because you just infer by the style of what this is. You just know. And I just remember, like, it was always a learning experience. So,
So
why wouldn't you want to work with as many of these people as you can in order to just learn by osmosis,
right.
You know?
Is Emil Richards still playing for you?
Emil still – yes, he is. And Emil, you know, Emil played – it's so fun to think that – oh, that bongo at the beginning of the Mission Impossible theme was Emil, you know? or all those mixing bowls and the weird sounds that I heard in Planet of the Apes as a kid, that was Emil.
Yep.
You know?
One of the legendary percussionists.
Yes.
On Hollywood soundtracks since the 50s.
Yeah. This guy has hung out with Frank Sinatra on his yacht. He was best friends with George Harrison. He was like, you know, Emil played and knew everybody, and played with everybody, knew everybody, and what an incredible gift I've had and able to have this relationship with him. The guy is incredible. We just worked together on The Last Planet of the Apes. He was on that.
Great.
Using the instruments that he used on the original Planet of the Apes.
Love it.
Which he passed on to me, and which I have. Which it's just again, when I think about things like that, I am so lucky that I get to do this because I love it. And the fact that so many things from my past, my childhood, I'm still surrounded by today.
Yeah.
Never in a million years, if you had told me, oh, the guy that's making those sounds and stuff and playing those instruments, you're going to be working with him one day. Mm. I never would have believed that. Or the fact that somebody said, you know, you're going to be working with Steven Spielberg one day.
Yeah.
You know, no. It's insane. It's insane.
But you made it happen.
Somehow.
Yeah.
You made it happen.
Yeah.
I think the talent helps.
Well,
I'm going to guess that's up there. Now, you are in a documentary, and that's going to be, you're saying it's going to be on PBS?
I saw that short called Montage, Great Film Composers on the Piano.
Yes. Gloria Chang, she's just incredible, right?
This is a remarkable, it's about 27 minutes long, and it she commissioned you, what's that guy's name, John Williams?
Yeah, he's just starting out,
right.
But
right.
I think he's going to be
great. Future for that kid.
Bruce Broughton, Don Davis, Alexandre Desplat.
Mm-hmm.
And Randy Newman,
yeah,
commissioned each of you to write a
piece. I know, all those names and me. It's so ridiculous.
For this brilliant classical pianist to perform.
Yes.
And it's not just that you did it, which would be enough, but the film is so well edited.
They did a beautiful job with that movie. They filmed everything and all the different rehearsals and mm-hmm. The film itself is a wonderful piece of art.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
In exploring what art is.
I looked it up. I just looked it up today on IMDb, of all places, to see, you know, something about where people could see it. And it is playing here in the local PBS station here in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
during this next week. So I encourage you, if you're curious, to do the same thing.
Say the name again.
It's called Montage, Great Film Composers and the Piano. And it has been on the film festival circuit. That's how I saw it.
I mean, what she wanted to do, I think, was just like, look, take the orchestra away from the composer and give him just the piano. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know? So much of what we do is big orchestral stuff. And it is nice when you're able to get more intimate with something and explore an instrument. And I think that's what she wanted us all to do, is just, all right, what's this person going to do if I just give them the piano? You know? And I remember just thinking, wait, why am I even doing this? John Williams is writing a piece. Randy Newman is writing. All these guys who I admire so much and I look up to. And I just, you know, Bruce Broughton, I think he's one of the best composers in town and one of the greatest orchestrators ever to live on the on this planet. The guy, his talent is through the roof. And his wife, Belinda, another unbelievable talent. She's my concertmaster. She's an incredible violinist. Just the most, I mean, so to be, thrown in with these kind of people, it's
incredible.
Sort of frightening and terrifying and wonderful all at once. But it's, I had a lot of fun doing it. And again, Gloria also played on Tomorrowland. We had two pianos on Tomorrowland.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Mark Gasparo and Gloria.
My dad's wearing a Tomorrowland
pin. I know.
I love that.
That makes me so happy. I keep a few of those in my car. And every time, you know, sometimes you run into strangers or something happens and someone does something nice to you or something, or you see somebody do something nice for them. I keep them in my car so I can give them to them.
Good for you. Passing it along.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Absolutely. It was a blast.
And we love talking to you.
Well.
And people know where to hear your music. Are you a social media person as well?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter,
He's hilarious.
@M_Giacchino. That's it on Twitter and on Instagram too. Same thing. And generally, you know, I don't get political or any of that stuff on it. To me, it's just about the fun of what I do and hopefully passing on some of that goofiness out into the world.
If you and Rich Moore are the two most ridiculously entertaining humans, please.
I love Rich.
Another day we'll tell our listeners the story of the utensil.
Oh,
molten utensil.
No, it has a name. It's the trident of molten.
The trident of molten.
Whoops.
Oh, so good. Whoops.
That'll be a mystery
for another
day.
Yeah, exactly. You'll just have to try and figure it out.
Well, I'll come back. We'll do another one.
Da-da-da, trident of molten.
This were a radio show, we'd have a kind of a tease at the end about the stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
I love old radio guys because you can tell their voices. Well, hi, it's nice to meet you. You're
it's
my
so
God. You must do radio.
Hey, a good radio voice is like, that's
what I wanted to be when I was a kid. To be a great announcer.
Uh-huh. What kind of stuff?
Any kind of stuff.
Like,
I mean, when I met Fred Foy, Fred Foy announced The Lone Ranger for years and years. And that became Dick Cavett's announcer. He was the staff announcer at ABC in New York. So he worked for decades. And he needed no prodding. if you put a needle on a record and started playing the William Tell Overture, he'd say, return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
So
he would just do it. Oh, man.
His favorite radio show one is just Suspense. Go on, say it.
Suspense.
That's the dude just walking around. Suspense.
I love that show too.
It's a great show.
Oh, it's an amazing show.
And when it isn't great, it's still good.
Oh, we should do a podcast about one of those shows.
Oh, you know, man, onward and upward with that. Thank you again, Michael.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It was so much fun.
And Jesse, they're looking for you. Where can they find you?
I am at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton.
It's true.
And you've also got leonardmalton.com where folks can subscribe and get your movie reviews.
It costs nothing.
It costs nothing.
We'll send you the email blast.
On life.
We'll let you know when I'm reviewing new movies or DVDs or covering film festivals or new film books or any number of other things.
We got lots of music in there.
We got stuff. Anyway, go to leonardmalton.com, and I'm thanking you in advance for doing that.
We thank you.
We thank you. I'll close with the words of George M. Cohan. My mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you. Thank you. Talk to you next time, folks.
Bye.
Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.